I'm pulling in my driveway. We all know what that means. It's time for the drive to work. Okay, so I have this ongoing series where I'm trying to talk about every magic set in existence. So recently I did a podcast on Betrayers of Kamigawa. So I'm now going to do that was the second set in the Champions of Kamigawa block. Now I'm going to do the third set today, Saviors of Kamigawa. So Saviors of Kamigawa comes out in June of 2005. It has 165 cards. So 55 commons, 55 uncommons, 55 rares. Mythic rare, not a thing yet. And 55 is because the sheets are 110. So it's each card appears twice on the sheet. The design team was led by Brian Tinsman, who also led the design for Champions of Kamigawa. So Brian led the first and third set in the block. I think I only did that once. I did that in Mirrodin. I did Mirrodin and Fifth Dawn. His team was himself, Brian Schneider, Brandon Bozzi, and Devin Lowe. Brandon was on the creative team. Brian and Devin were both head developer at one point. And then the lead of the development team was Randy Bueller, and Brian Schneider, Worth Woolport, Mont Johnson, and Justin Webb were on the development team. Some of those names you might recognize. Jeremy Crawford was the art director. Okay, so this was the third set in the block. Now, longtime listeners know that one of the reasons we stopped doing blocks was what we referred to as the third block problem, which just became the second block problem when we cut down from three sets to two sets. The core thing is, the way we used to do blocks is we would make the first set, and then the second and third set would sort of like try to expand on what the first two sets did. In the early days, you weren't allowed to add mechanics. So in the early days, like, the first set would introduce phasing and flanking. And then the third set could use phasing and flanking, but they didn't get to do new named mechanics. Eventually realized that we needed something, you know, like, the third set kind of... usually what happened was people were very excited for the first set. There was some excitement for the second set, but not as much as for the first set. And then by the third set, you're like, okay, can we move on already? So what started happening is the third set started having what we call the third set pivot, where we would do something radically different in the third set just to try to shake things up. So Brian's idea for this set, his sort of big twist, was what he called Wisdom was the name, that's what he dubbed the theme. So Wisdom stood for Hand Size Matters. And we had done a bunch of cards where hand size matters. Mara was a real famous one where, like, oh, well, the bigger your hand, the bigger the creature is. And so Brian really got it in his head that it'd be fun. We were, you know, doing Japanese mythology and, oh, the idea of wisdom and caring about your hand. So he did a lot of things to care about your hand. Now, first and foremost, it did carry over some of the mechanics. Soul Shift, Splice into Arcane, the Arcane Super Type. There were flip cards. Although this set did do something new with flip cards. This had some creatures that flipped into enchantments. So it starts as a creature, but when it flips, when you rotate 180 degrees, it becomes an enchantment. That was something a little bit new. But the new things in the set, this set actually introduced three new keywords. It's sort of an evolution. You start seeing us introduce, Mirrodin had done it, Fifth Dawn introduced some new keywords, Scry, for example, was introduced. So we sort of said, okay, how do we solve this third set problem? Well, what if the third set just did some new stuff, and it can have new mechanics and such? So Brian introduced three mechanics. First was Sweep. So Sweep allowed you to return some number of basic land. They would say, Sweep, so return some number of islands or something. Usually it was whatever color you were. If it was a red card, return some number of mountains, basic mountains. And the idea was that the effect of the spell got enhanced by more lands you returned. There weren't a lot of Sweep cards. I think there were only four, I want to say. There weren't a lot of Sweep cards. And the idea behind Sweep was, oh, I care about the size of my hand. Oh, well, later in the game, when maybe I don't need my mana as much, I can return some of my mana to my hand to help fill my hand up again, to help with these wisdom cards. Sweep had a bunch of issues. It wasn't on enough cards really to justify the keyword. It wasn't the kind of thing people want to keyword. Like, it didn't make a good keyword. It didn't play all that great, and it didn't really need a name. But it's the kind of keyword we make fun of these days just because it's kind of... For example, did we need to keyword this? Also, channel. So channel is one of the two named mechanics that we brought back in Kamigawa Neon Dynasty. Channel basically says you may pay mana and discard this card from your hand. We do that all the time. We don't normally name it. I think Brian was trying to hand as a focus, so he decided to name it. We brought it back in Kamigawa Neon Dynasty because our pickings were slim of what to bring back. And it wasn't that channel was an amazing mechanic. It just was something that we do, and we could have the name, and we could do it. And so we did bring it back. Channel, the only thing with channel is you're sort of naming something we just naturally do that doesn't really need a name. But once again, you're channeling things, it's your inner wisdom, you know. And like I said, it plays into this hand as a resource. Okay, and the final mechanic that he introduced was Epic, which was on a cycle of rares. Epic is one of those mechanics... I think I picked Epic when I did my top 20 worst mechanics. I might have also picked Sweep. Epic was a mechanic. They were enchantments. And when you played them, it said, you can't play any other spells for the rest of the game. But, I will do an effect every turn. Every upkeep, I do an effect. But the cost of that effect is you can't ever play spells again. Now, the white one let you tutor to go get enchantments, I think, and then play them. So, that one at least is letting you sort of do a variety of different things. But anyway, the idea of I have a cool spell again every turn is neat. The idea that I can't ever cast spells again, not so neat. So those were the brand new things. There also, by the way, was a Morrow cycle in the set that all had Morrow in their name. For those that somehow don't know this, I made a card all the way back in Mirage. It was a creature for 2 green-green whose stats, with power and toughness, were equal to the number of cards in your hand. And for a while, Morrow was... It showed up in tournament play. So Brian made a cycle of Morrows, and it turns out that Morrow means something in Japanese. But anyway, they ended up naming... Morrow is in the name of all 5 of these creatures. The interesting thing about this, early Magic, in fact, Morrow is a good example. We occasionally would do things. Morrow was named after me. There was a hole in the Mirage file. I had made this card before coming to Wizards. I pitch it in the meeting. Bill likes it, and he puts it in the file. And so Bill labeled it with what he typed in when he wants to get me, that I made the card. And he had learned way back when, if you would type in letters... Once you got unique letters, it would fill it in. So he learned that for me, if he typed in M-A-R-O, M-A for Mark, R-O for Rosewater, it would self-automate Mark Rosewater. So he just put Morrow on the card, more for his shorthand of, this is Mark's card. But creators said, that sounds cool, and they left it there. And so that is what we call a vanity card. It is named after one of the people that make Magic. At one period of time, we stopped. Vanity cards got banned. We don't do vanity cards anymore. It just had weird internal, it's like if one person gets it, why doesn't everyone get it? Anyway, it just caused weird internal things. So we stopped doing it. But the interesting thing is, so Morrow is grandfathered in the sense that the Morrow creature type, the Morrow is not creature type, but it's a kind of creature. It's a nature spirit. That still exists. We didn't erase things that had been vanity in their creation. Mons, for example, is named after Mons Johnson, one of the people on the development team. But Mons is also a character. So Mons still gets to show up because things that got introduced as vanity still get to stay, but we don't introduce any more vanity things. So anyway, I, in 2004, this came out in 2005, had my twins, Adam and Sarah. So this set has what we call an accidental vanity card, where everybody thinks it's a vanity card, but it's not. So all the Morrow were named after words, the Japanese root words and stuff. So one of them is Adamaro, A-D-A-M-A-R-O, and the other is Soramaro, S-O-R-A-M-A-R-O. Everybody in the world thinks that they're named after my children. They're not. No one intentionally did that. The words were chosen to be the things that match what they were trying to do. No one believes me, probably most of you don't believe me, but I swear, I both had nothing to do with it, nor did the people who name it try to do that. But it's one of my favorite accidental, you know, vanity cards in quotes. It's just not a vanity card. Where everybody assumes it's a vanity card, but it's not. Okay. So basically, the set was trying to build on what had come before and was trying to sort of definitionally give it its own feel to it. So I think the problem with the wisdom theme, I mean, I obviously made Mara. Like, I think from every once in a while having a card where you don't want to play cards is okay. And I think that as a singular theme in a singular deck can be fun. As a major theme of the whole set, of something you're trying to play limited with, it's a little reductive of a theme in the sense that in order for it to work, you kind of have to not do things. It's a very passive mechanic. Now, there are ways in larger formats to build around it where you're drawing extra cards and stuff. And as I'll get to when I get to individual cards, there are plenty of cards in the set that do see play. But I think the wisdom mechanic was not the strongest of mechanics. I get one of the things that Brian Tinsman, so for those that don't know Brian Tinsman, Brian worked at Wizards for many years. He and I are good friends. Brian really liked exploring the unexplored. And I think he was enamored by the idea that we hadn't done a lot with hand size matters. So he just thought it was an area to explore. He was right. It was an unexplored area. And like I said, there are some cool things about it. It's not like you can't do things with it. And I think in a constructed standpoint, like, it's a fine theme to focus a constructed deck around. That is fine. It's just a little bit much of a theme. Don't do things is not a strong set theme. And as evidenced by the new mechanics, like I said, I think both Sweep and Epic were on my list of top 20 worst mechanics of all time. So if you have three new mechanics and two of the three make my list 30 years in of the worst mechanics of all time, not strong. So this set struggled a bit. Champions of Kamigawa block as a whole, for those that know their history, did not perform well. We have a lot of metrics that we look at. I believe organized play was down, sales were down. To this day, I believe Champions of Kamigawa has the lowest marks for creative, for a world that we've done. Now, as I mentioned in the Betrayers of Kamigawa post, kind of what happened is Kamigawa really was not seen as a very positive thing by most people. But then, with time, a couple things happened. One is, I think at the time, Japanese mythology was not that well understood. And so to a lot of people, it just felt like, it's weird stuff that I don't understand. The rise of Japanese pop culture is really a dominant force in pop culture, really did more to sort of inform people. And so I think the average person just became much more aware of Japanese mythology than they had been originally, so that was part of it. And the second thing is, what I had dubbed at the time a mistake in Champions, which is making all the rares legendary creatures, which carried out through the whole block, by the way, it turns out that, oh, well, legendary creature took on a whole new meaning later in life as the Commander format became popular. And a lot of early Magic sets, we did not have a lot of legendary creatures. Like, it wasn't uncommon to have three or four in the whole set. All of a sudden, having a set just dripping, and not just with, like, obviously, the ones we normally do are playing into story, but this set just had a lot of weird, quirky, like, this set kind of leaned into the quirky, definitely influenced Brian. And so there's a lot of quirky designs on legendary creatures that are actually very fun to build around. So Champions of Kamigawa block ended up being a boon for the Commander format. And I think a lot of that is why it sort of, like, the reason we did Neon Dynasty as Kamigawa, the story for that set goes, we were going to make a brand new world based on Japanese pop culture. And I, because my blog was so insistent that we go back to Kamigawa, said, you know, we don't have to decide that yet. Let's just make the set and see where it goes. And then I and some other people worked very hard to make sure it was Kamigawa, and we made this whole modern versus tradition thing to help bring back, you know, half the set what was old Kamigawa. But anyway, At the time, Champions was not, like I said, it was a bit powered down from Urza's Saga block that preceded, because Urza's Saga was broken. The theme was not quite understood at the time, and stuff like Saviors did not do a lot to sort of, like, it was a third set. People were kind of tired of the set because of the third set problem in general. And I just don't think this twist was the kind of twist that really reinvigorated anything. It was looking in different space. I agree there. It was definitely doing something we hadn't done much of. But I'm in with 2020 hindsight. To be fair to Brian, hey, you figure out areas we haven't done that you think might be fun, and you try them. Morrow was a fun card. As a fan of Morrow, I just don't think that theme works in small doses. Okay. So now I'm going to get to some cards that got designed. These are some of the most played cards, mostly in Commander. Okay, so first is Miko Koro, Center of the Sea. It's a legendary land. You can tap to add sea, add colors, or for two and tap, each player draws a card. So I assume this gets played in decks where you're trying to play nice with everybody and... don't kill me, because I'm the nice guy helping everybody get cards. The set had so legendary was the theme of Champions of Kawagawa block. So not only were there legendary creatures, but there were legendary enchantments, there were legendary lands, there were legendary artifacts. So there was a lot of legendary stuff. The set was really dripping with a legendary. Okay. Oh, I would say, by the way, just real quick, we do not tend to like to put legendary on lands. We do it occasionally. And usually if the land has some built-in way to help you if there's duplication, for example, I think there was some in this set that had channel, right? Well, if I can't play the land because I have a legendary land, the same legendary land in play, well, I can use this channel ability, for example. Okay, next, Freed from the Realm. So this is an aura, 2U enchant creature, enchantment aura. So it has two activations. For blue mana, you can tap enchanted creature, or for blue mana, you can untap enchanted creature. So this is a fun design. This is something that we like to do a lot of, which is... So auras were introduced in Alpha, and they were pretty popular out of the gate. The variance between how much beginners like auras and how good auras are, meaning how much they're played by more experienced players who more understand the power level, is very high. They're super fun. They're not so good. They come with inherent card disadvantage. And so we've forever been trying to ways to make auras a little bit better. We get that there are players that really like auras, but man, they're hard to play. So this aura was doing double duty, which is interesting. This aura can function as removal or pseudo-removal. If I put this on my opponent's creature, especially a big creature that's more about attacking, well, once a turn, I can tap it down to keep it from attacking me. Or I can put it on my own creature if my creature has a tap ability, or even if I'm attacking with a large creature but I want to sort of give it pseudo-vigilance, I can spend mana to untap it. So we like doing this idea where the aura has different functionality depending on how you use it. And the clever part of this design is the two abilities feel connected. Spend blue mana, tap the creature. Spend blue mana, untap the creature. You're not really going to do the same thing on the same kind of creature most of the time. But it is interesting that, like, the parallelism feels really good. The two abilities feel like they go together, even though, interestingly, they really have very different uses. But anyway, this card is nice in that it has this double function, that one of the things you can do, if you're playing a deck where you need it for, like, combo potential, I'm going to untap a piece of mine. Early on, I can use it as removal if I need to, if I get in trouble. So it's kind of neat that it's a combo piece that has a secondary function that can be removal. So I think that's why it's so played. Next, Kami of the Crescent Moon. Legendary creature, spirit, 1/3. At the beginning of each player's turn, that player draws a card. A couple things. So one is, for those who don't know the story, basically the Emperor of the World, Kondo is his name, robs, I forget what it's called, this like spirit baby from the spirit realm. The spirit realm freaks out, as they should, and then there's a war between the spirit realm and the physical realm. So the spirit realm was filled with kami, which is Japanese, I think, for spirit. And so we had a long spirit theme, soul shift, and, you know, there's a lot of caring about spirits in different mechanical ways. The one thing is we made them, the spirits look very weird. And it's kind of fun, and they look cool. And I think with time, people have really grown to appreciate them. But early on, they were just like, who are these weird creatures? But they represent, so the spirits can be spirits of all sorts of different things. And so, like this one is the spirit of the moon, for example. The other interesting thing is, in Alpha, there's a card called Howling Mine. Howling Mine was an artifact that every turn let players draw an extra card. This basically is a legendary creature that functions as a Howling Mine. As you can see with Miko Koro, a lot of the friendly... This set lent itself well to a lot of the friendly play. Part of which is it wanted to get cards in hand because of the wisdom theme, but just drawing cards, there's a limitation on how much we could do that. So there is a bunch of everybody draws sort of stuff that's universal. And that definitely... I guess they call it a group hug deck. It's something in which in Commander, where you're trying to sort of be everybody's friend and be the person they don't want to kill because you're just helping everybody. Cards like this are really good. Okay, next, Sakasha. Sakasha, the imposter. So 2 blue-blue for a legendary creature, human rogue, 3/1. When it enters, it can become the copy of any creature on the battlefield, but it also has a text, 2 blue-blue, return this to hand at end of turn. So the idea is that in Alpha, there's a card called Vesuvan Doppelganger. Vesuvan Doppelganger, basically, when you play it, you could copy anything, but it keeps the ability that it can copy new things. This is basically a Vesuvan Doppelganger. It makes you bounce it back to your hand. The one value to that is not only can you reset it, but you can use it as protection. Oh, they're trying to destroy it? Oh, well, if I have 4 mana available, I can bounce it in my hand. So not only does it allow you to reset things, but it allows you to protect it. And so that, like I said, the nice thing about Vesuvan Doppelganger is it doesn't cost anything to copy something new, where this one you have to bounce it and recast it. So this one's a little bit more expensive to change what it is. But the fact that it can protect itself is extra added value. Okay, next, Sakura Tribe Scout. Green creature, snake shaman scout, 1/1, tap, put a land from your hand onto the battlefield. As I said, because there's stuff like sweep that puts lands into your hand, one of the themes of getting your hand bigger is getting things back. And land, it is true that land, there's a point in the game where you don't need land as much as you need it early in the game, that you return something. That's what sweep's trying to play around with. But I think Brian was saying, well, if I'm going to return land to your hand, let me give you some tools to get it back out. And this has proven to be a popular way in Commander. The ability to ramp is pretty important, meaning to get mana out faster than normal. And so this is a good card to help you ramp. It is one of the snake. So one of the things we did is each color had a sort of an animal creature type that comes from mythology. Well, I guess redhead goblins, but the white-headed foxes, the blue-headed the moonfolk that were sort of a rabbit-ish. The black-headed rats, red-headed goblins, and green-headed snakes. A lot of the snakes, by the way, had this theme where it would, when it hit them, it would lock something down. When it hit a creature, it would lock it down for a turn. But not all of them did. Okay, next up, Riki, the History of Kamigawa. 2 and a green, legendary creature, human shaman, 1/2. Whenever you play a legendary creature, or sorry, a legendary spell, draw a card. So one of the things we like to do, it's a common, what is the set about? Okay, the set's about thing X. Well, let's have a card that says, when you do thing X, draw a card. And so this one, like I said, legendary is a big theme of the block. It's why all the rare creatures are legendary, why there's unlegendary creatures, which at the time was not something we did very often. There's legendary artifacts and enchantments and lands and anyway, lots and lots of legendary things. It is, so anyway, and the other thing is because in Commander, so the legendary drawback is, if you already have copy of that permanent in play, you can't play it, or you can play it, I guess, technically, and then one of them gets sacrificed. So, But anyway, in a commander format where you don't have duplicates, or it's very hard to have duplicates. I mean, you can copy things. The legendary restriction is a lot less. So playing a deck all full of legends, where that might be more problematic in a 60 card format where you're doubling up, it is not so in the commander format. Okay, next. Oboru, Palace in the Clouds, a legendary land, tap to add blue, or one, return card name to owner's hand. So one of the interesting things, this is a legendary land. The reason it's a legendary land is one of the things we try to do, although we've loosened a little with time, is we try not to usurp basic land. What it means is, oh, if I'm a land and you can tap and add blue, we wanted you to sort of have some secondary cost to that. So in this set, we do that with legendary. Like, well, okay, but it's not better than a basic land, only because it's restrictive how often you can use it. The other thing about this is the reason you can return it to your hand, once again, plays into the wisdom theme that we want. It allows you, I mean, and there's some interesting things it can do, but the most reason it's there is to allow you to have more cards in your hand when you need it. It also has some fun, like, interacts with, it will later interact with Landfall, for example, that I can play it, trigger Landfall. Oh, no, I can't replay it because anyway, I guess that doesn't work. I mean, I guess if you already have it in play, you can bounce it to your hand so you can play it to trigger Landfall, I guess is what I meant to say. Okay, next. Pithing Needle, one artifact. Name a card. Pithing Needle's on the battlefield, players cannot play activated abilities of the named card. So Pithing Needle's interesting. Pithing Needle got added in development, and I don't remember what it was trying to solve, but there was... Urza Saga had been the set before this, and Urza Saga was causing all sorts of problems. It was a Barokian, as we say. And so one of the things that we try to do in the next set, or next block often, is provide answers for the trouble cards of the block before. So I forget what Pithing Needle was shutting off, and probably more than one thing. But Pithing Needle was made as a, there's a problem card. Okay, here's a tool. You can shut down this problem card. And because Pithing Needle exists as an answer, maybe it restricts a little bit how often people are playing that. We learn in general that answer cards are dangerous in the sense that, or not dangerous, if the answer card is too narrow, then, if people stop playing it, then they stop playing the answer card. It goes back and forth. Pithing Needle is interesting in that it usually has some functionality. It's stronger in some decks against some decks than others, but even if what you're expecting to Pithing Needle doesn't come to pass, you can Pithing Needle other things. But anyway, Pithing Needle's been... a lot of these cards I've been talking about today are kind of big players in Commander. Pithing Needle actually sees a lot of play in constructed formats because it's a very powerful answer to some very powerful cards. Okay, next. Mashiko Kanda, Truth Seeker. 3 and a white, so 4 mana total, one of which is light. Legendary creature, human advisor. She's a 2/2. Whenever the opponent damages you with a permanent, they have to sacrifice that permanent. So the idea is anything can damage you, but then it goes away. It's interesting, the first card that did this actually was black. It was in Urza's Legacy. What's the name of it? We made a holiday card that made fun of it. No Mercy. We made Snow Mercy was the holiday card. No Mercy is kind of this in black form. But anyway, I think Mashiko Kanda, she might be the Empress. I mean, Kanda is the Emperor. Kondo raised Gerard. Kanda is the Emperor, and my guess is this is his wife or daughter, but I think it's his wife. Okay, and once again, another good example of a legendary card that really you can build around and do fun things with, or I don't know fun, but do things with. Okay, next, Onaginata. This is an equipment, one and an artifact. You can only attach it to creatures with power 3 or greater. It gives the creature +3/+0 and trample, equip 2. So this is us messing around a little bit with the idea of it's more powerful, but it's more restrictive what you can put it on. And so the idea is really what we want to do is make big creatures bigger, not make little creatures into big creatures. That's why the restriction's there. And this has definitely seen a bunch of play. The final card to talk about is Twin Cast. I believe I was responsible for this card. Blue, it's basically Fork from Alpha. Fork was one of my favorite cards. And I always thought, like, blue should have access to Fork, so I made a blue Fork. Interestingly, I'm not sure whether I was supposed to make it at the time. I don't know whether it violated the restricted list. But anyway, we did, and it exists now, and we can. I mean, it exists, and we can reprint it. I love copying things, for those that somehow don't know that. And I like copying things in all forms. But copying spells as you cast them, super fun. And it felt like red has it. Not that red shouldn't have it, but I think blue should have it too. So I made a Fork in blue. We joked for a while that it was, we could call it spoon. So it's Fork and spoon. I'm almost to work here. So let's wrap this up. Saviors of Kamigawa is not, in 2020 hindsight, not what I would call one of our strongest sets. In fact, if one day I did the 20 weakest sets or most problematic sets, it would make that list. Like I said, the fact that two of its mechanics were on my 20 worst mechanics list is not ideal. I do think it was trying something different. I applaud that. And sometimes you try something different, it doesn't work out. It ended up being not... I mean, like I said, there's plenty of cards people play from it. I think Kamigawa block in general, especially because of the legendary creatures, has gone on to have a secondary usage that I think in the time wasn't quite appreciated. So I think with a modern light, I mean, maybe I can be kinder to Kamigawa than I'm being here. I think Kamigawa has gone on to have a lot more legs than we expected when we first made it. While the wisdom theme maybe didn't pay off in great... I mean, there are individual decks that do some of those things. So in Constructed, it made a little more sense than in Limited. And there are plenty of one-off cards that people really do enjoy. There are a lot of gems hidden in Champs Kamigawa block. So maybe with hindsight, it ended up being a little bit better than its first reaction was. And so, because his first reaction was not great. I mean, third sets, it was a third set that had a twist that didn't end up panning out quite the way we wanted, in a block that people were kind of tired of when the first set came out. So, but like I said, sometimes time can heal. And I think Kamigawa block definitely, with just a different vantage point and other things that, like, there's things that made it shine that didn't shine in the moment, but shine after the fact. So anyway... Saviors of Kamigawa, it's definitely one of our more interesting attempts to do something different. But that, my friends, I guess, like I said, I'm just driving up to work. That is all I have to say about Champs of Kamigawa. Not Champs of Kamigawa, Saviors. That's all I have to say about Saviors of Kamigawa. But anyway, I would, by the way, recommend with any of these talks when I walk through things, if you've never really seen the set, go online, pick your favorite database, and take a look at it. There's a lot of fun stuff in old sets that you might not realize. And one of the things that's really fun about looking at old things is you might discover things that you go, hey, that would go in my deck right now. You know. And so whenever I talk about sets, it can't hurt with my giving you some context to go back and look at it. It can't hurt to take a look. But anyway, guys, now that I'm done talking about Saviors of Kamigawa, it is time for me. This is the end of my drive to work. So instead of talking magic, it's time for me to be making magic. I'll see you next time. Bye-bye.